I think I failed. No, actually, I think I never really started. I tried to. I took a step forward, worked hard up to a point, but when it came time to really go for it, to charge people for my work, I got scared and pulled back. Telling myself it was insane to charge people for so little. Knowing that I just wasn't able to keep up in the future, that I could never do more than that, at least not on my own. And the one person I believed was perfect for this job, the first and only person I hired to help realize my vision, quit on the very first day of trying. Maybe this is just hard to pull off, or maybe I'm not great at explaining my ideas, at bringing people on board my ship, or maybe this whole thing was flawed from the start. Let me explain. If you followed my journey so far, you know I wanted to create a business this summer to really get things rolling. Since I doubt I'll dive back into that business anytime soon, I feel okay sharing a little more about it. I make animated medical YouTube videos to help med students understand complex concepts in minutes, stuff that took me hours to grasp. This all started back in 2020, right at the beginning of COVID, my first year of medical school. Back then, I barely knew how to study. I'd only had one semester and a bit of in-person classes before everything went remote, forcing us to learn alone from slides designed to be explained by professors. It was all so abstract, and with no interactive resources or AI tools like we have now, I felt completely lost. Then I stumbled into some high-quality textbooks like Netter's Histology and Grey's Anatomy. And no, I don't mean the TV show. These books became my lifeline, packed with all the information I craved. I was obsessed with learning and didn't have much else to do. At the same time, I started watching creators like Ali Abdaal talking about YouTube as a way to earn income while sharing knowledge. So on May 17th, 2020, I launched my first YouTube channel, Be The Greatest, posting motivational content. Technically, though, that wasn't my very first YouTube channel. When I was 13, I created one on June 5th, 2014, where I uploaded a few song covers. I called the channel Dunya Cover Song. Very creative, I know. One of my videos, a Miley Cyrus cover, actually got 1,000 views, and I thought I was going to be famous in just a couple of weeks. But of course, that didn't happen. I ended up deleting that video, though the channel still exists with just one video left. I'll put the link in the description if you want to check it out. That same day, May 17th, 2020, I also created another channel, Sing for Fun, where I uploaded one cover song. And somewhere along the way, just a few days afterwards actually, I created what's now my main channel, BIP. Short for Be Insanely Productive. As you can probably tell, I'm a very creative person. Just look at the channel names I come up with. Naming things comes naturally to me. In fact, Chasing My Hero is probably the only name I managed to make somewhat decent, or at least I hope so. And not only am I bursting with creativity, but I also have a knack for juggling multiple things at once, as you can see. Making motivational videos was a struggle, mainly due to copyright issues. Plus, my whole life, people have discouraged me from getting into the music business because of its bad reputation. So I eventually stopped making videos for those two channels. But what was BIP about? Well, at first I was as clueless as you. I had no idea what to focus on. My first video was about how to make money online by creating YouTube videos, something I hadn't even achieved myself. But the thing was, all I really knew was how to study, thanks to watching great study videos by Ali Abdaal. Since there were no French resources on this, I decided to translate his methods into French. Then I started making videos on routine and intermittent fasting. Things I had tried and that worked for me. But on July 19th, 2020, everything changed. I watched a video from the American medical channel Osmosis about OCD, and I thought, why not translate that? So I did. That video changed everything for my channel, though I didn't realize its impact until weeks later. I then started making more videos on general medical topics, because that was interesting. Like, what is hematocrit? And what is a heart attack? Those were things I wanted to know more about. And so I made sure to understand those subjects and then just make videos about them. Soon I started receiving questions like, can you analyze my blood work and what should I do? I was scared because I didn't feel qualified to answer these questions. But I understood that this type of content was valuable. Being a medical student, I felt a sense of responsibility to share what I was learning, but I didn't want the pressure of offering medical advice without sufficient knowledge. I wanted to share what I had learned from the incredible textbooks I was reading, content that would be valuable to others struggling like I had. So I made a video on September 12, 2020 about a particularly challenging subject. From there, I kept making more videos, and that marked the beginning of one of my most successful channels. Fast forward to now, and I'm beyond grateful that BIP has over 40,000 subscribers and videos with 100,000 views, which is, yes, mind-blowing. It's still pretty moderate compared to the growth of other channels. Honestly, at the beginning I wanted something big, like a million subscribers kind of channel. But as I started making the videos, I realized that the process was more rewarding than the results, until it wasn't anymore. As I began drawing illustrations and striving for more polished videos, the process became overwhelming. It took hours and hours, and yet I could never finish a video on time. Once a week was the goal. Then, as COVID ended, I had to get out, go to the hospital, and suddenly had way less time to read and process information. I was waking up earlier. I was sleeping later. I was making time here and there, but it wasn't enough. I wanted to add more, make videos more complete, explain everything that didn't make sense, and my videos started getting longer and harder to create. Eventually, I started producing less and less content until it became just once every few months. Combine that with the burnout and the mental strain of med school, and it all became unbearable. It stopped being fun. What once was a deviation from my daily life became another form of work, another version of studying, and I just didn't want to do more of that. But all along, I've always wanted to make an impact, help a lot of people, and also earn a decent income. I wanted to support my family financially because I knew that with med school, I was using all of their resources without truly giving back. I wanted to change that, to finally be financially independent and stop being a burden. So just before the summer, I made a decision. I was going to start a business. But the question was, what should I focus on? The only thing I really knew how to do was create explanatory animated medical videos. I knew they helped people, and after doing some market research, I realized there was a demand. There were no good educational video platforms for medical students in my part of the world. So I thought I'll do this. But then I faced a major hurdle. I didn't know how to code. So I had to find a middle ground. A way to launch before I could afford to hire developers or build a full website. I decided on a private Telegram channel to share my videos without allowing downloads. I was ready for it. I set up a bank account, started working on a video, and realized I couldn't do this alone, so I tried to find someone to help me. I did find someone, a friend who was studying just like me, but on the first day of working together, they told me it was too much. They said there was no way they could keep up with it during the year. The truth was, I knew I couldn't do it all myself, and I didn't want to. I didn't want to be studying and making multiple videos for different modules while also preparing for my current year. As I watched videos from people like Alex Hormozi and Ali Abdaal, I couldn't help but admit that the business model I was trying to create didn't sit right with me. I didn't want to make money off of students who were struggling just to buy books or maybe even food. I realized it wasn't sustainable or fair. And I didn't want to sacrifice more time and money on a project I didn't fully believe in. Yes, the YouTube channel is important. Yes, it's valuable to make videos for students, but I finally admitted to myself I didn't want to build my business around that. I realized I didn't have the passion for it, and so I gave up and still uploaded the video I made to YouTube. But it's okay, really. Because yes, I'm still going to make YouTube videos from time to time. I'm still going to contribute to the medical knowledge, but I'm not going to put more efforts than I can. And the fact that I gave up on this business is okay, really, because as we discussed in the first episode, this journey isn't always about succeeding and reaching a specific destination. Sometimes it's just as important to recognize when something isn't valuable enough to keep fighting for. But the real question is, what is valuable enough for me? To understand that, I had to dig deep to study and put in the hours. To do that, I wanted to read this seemingly incredible essay called How to Do Great Work by Paul Graham, because after all, that was and is the whole purpose of this chase. Now, this is no short read. It's nearly 9,000 word essay. So I'm going to share the insights that hit me the hardest. But if you can, please take the time to read it yourself. It's truly worth every minute. Believe it or not, I tried to make this essay as short as I could, but its length at least means it acts as a filter. If you made it this far, you must be interested in doing great work. And if so, you're already further along than you might realize, because the set of people willing to want to is small. The factors in doing great work are factors in the literal mathematical sense, and they are ability, interest, effort, and luck. Luck, by definition, you can't do anything about, so we can ignore that. And we can assume effort if you do, in fact, want to do great work. So the problem boils down to ability and interest. Can you find a kind of work where your ability and interest will combine to yield an explosion of new ideas? Here, there are grounds for optimism. There are so many different ways to do great work, and even more that are still undiscovered. Out of all those different types of work, the one you're most suited for is probably a pretty close match. It's just a question of finding it, and how far into it your ability and interest can take you. And you can only answer that by trying. So I'm going to pull a sneaky trick on you. Do you want to do great work or not? Now you have to decide consciously. Sorry about that. I wouldn't have done it to a general audience, but we already know you're interested. Don't worry about being presumptuous. You don't have to tell anyone. And if it's too hard and you fail, so what? Lots of people have worse problems than that. In fact, you'll be lucky if it's the worst problem you have. Yes, you'll have to work hard, but again, lots of people have to work hard. And if you're working on something you find very interesting, which you necessarily will if you're on the right path, the work will probably feel less burdensome than a lot of your peers. The discoveries are out there, waiting to be made. Why not by you? I started with Graham's conclusion because it shows how essential it is to take this essay seriously. I remember hearing David Senra, the host of the Founders Podcast, mention that if you couldn't make time to read a piece like this, you're not serious about the journey toward doing great work. So after reading all of that, was there a simple rule, a guiding principle for doing great work? I believe there is, and Paul Graham explains it far better than I ever could. Curiosity is the best guide. Your curiosity never lies, and it knows more than you do about what's worth paying attention to. Notice how often that word has came up. If you asked an oracle the secret to doing great work, and the oracle replied with a single word, my bet would be on curiosity. That doesn't translate directly to advice. It's not enough just to be curious. And you can't command curiosity anyway, but you can nurture it and let it drive you. Curiosity is the key to all four steps in doing great work. It will choose the field for you, get you to the frontier, cause you to notice the gaps in it, and drive you to explore them. The whole process is a kind of dance with curiosity. So, what are you genuinely curious about? What topic holds your attention for hours without wearing thin? That's what you should pursue. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's break down the steps of doing great work. The first step is to decide what to work on. The work you choose needs to have three qualities. It has to be something you have a natural aptitude for, that you have a deep interest in, and that offers scope to do great work. In practice, you don't have to worry much about the third criterion. So all you need to do is find something you have an aptitude for and great interest in. That sounds straightforward, but it's often quite difficult. When you're young, you don't know what you're good at or what different kinds of work are like. Some kinds of work you end up doing may not even exist yet. So while some people know what they want to do at 14, most have to figure it out. The way to figure out what to work on is by working. If you're not sure what to work on, guess, but pick something and get going. You'll probably guess wrong some of the time, but that's fine. It's good to know about multiple things. Some of the biggest discoveries come from noticing connections between different fields. This reminds me of something I read in The Defining Decade by Meg Jay. In this insightful book, Meg Jay, a therapist and author, explores the struggles of people in their 20s as they try to choose a job that feels authentic and original, while also aiming to make an impact. She shares the story of Ian, a young man who resisted the idea of a typical 9-to-5 office job, disdaining anything conventional and fearing a life of sameness. This is so relatable. Meg Jay describes it like this. To Ian, claiming was conforming. By starting a career, he imagined he was agreeing to decades of the status quo. Saying yes to one concrete thing felt like saying no to an interesting or limitless life. In fact, it's the other way around. If Ian didn't say yes to something, his life was going to become unremarkable and limited. In their sessions, the conversation often went like this. You need to claim something, she would say. And Ian would respond, but claiming something feels like losing everything else. Or he'd say, I don't want to settle for some ordinary thing. To which she'd reply, I'm not talking about settling, I'm talking about starting. 20-somethings who don't get started wind up with blank resumes and out-of-touch lives only to settle far more down the road. What's so original about that? One day, though, Jay noticed Ian's enthusiasm for customized bikes, and she used it as a powerful metaphor for life. I asked Ian what a custom bike said about him, compared to a mass-produced one he could buy anywhere, even one that might be easier to maintain. He said the bike represented his feeling that he wanted to be the product of different parts, someone who couldn't be defined by a label. Ian's desire for a custom bike was a sincere reflection of what he wanted for himself. He wanted his life to be singular, complex, and great. Jay continued, so a customized bike fits you, I said. Yeah. And it's unique, I said. Yeah. It feels authentic and different, even limitless in a way, because you can keep changing it over time. Yeah, exactly. But you started with some standard parts. You didn't literally reinvent the wheel. No, he said, smiling. I didn't. Then she offered him a new perspective. I asked Ian to consider that maybe that's what an authentic, unique life is. In the 21st century, careers and lives don't roll off an assembly line. We have to put together the pieces ourselves. Ian's life could be personalized and changeable, but it was going to take some time and effort. And he would probably need to start with some common parts. Having an uncommon life wasn't going to come from resisting these choices. It was going to come from making these choices. Same as the bike, Ian could imagine building a life, one job or one piece of capital at a time. It seemed less conforming and less terrifying than feeling like his next move would decide the one way his life was going to be forever. Let's go back to our essay. So, to recap, the first step is to pick something to start working on and be curious enough all along. But what should that first step look like? In other words, what type of work should you start with? Develop a habit of working on your own projects. Don't let work mean something others tell you to do. If you do manage to do great work one day, it will probably be on a project of your own. It may be part of a larger project, but you'll be driving your part of it. What should your projects be? Whatever seems to you excitingly ambitious. And here he emphasizes curiosity and personal interest again. What are you excessively curious about? Curious to a degree that would bore most other people. That's what you're looking for. Once you've found something you're excessively interested in, the next step is to learn enough about it to get to one of the frontiers of knowledge. Knowledge expands fractally, and from a distance, its edges look smooth, but as you get close, they turn out to be full of gaps. The next step is to notice them. Many discoveries come from asking questions about things everyone else takes for granted. So overall, there are four steps. Choose a field, learn enough to get to the frontier, notice gaps, explore promising ones. This is how practically everyone who's done great work has done it, from painters to physicists. Steps 2 and 4 will require hard work. That's why it's essential to work on something you're deeply interested in. Interest will drive you to work harder than mere diligence ever could. The three most powerful motives are curiosity, delight, and the desire to do something impressive. Sometimes they converge, and that combination is the most powerful of all. This essay practically answers every question I've ever had about finding meaningful work and excelling at it. But it only gets better, so let's dive deeper. Let's talk a little more about the complicated business of figuring out what to work on. The main reason it's hard is that you can't tell what most kinds of work are like except by doing them, which means the four steps overlap. You may have to work at something for years before you know how much you like it or how good you are at it. And in the meantime, you're not doing, and thus not learning about most other kinds of work. So in the worst case, you choose late based on very incomplete information. Ambition comes in two forms, one that precedes interest in the subject and one that grows out of it. Most people who do great work have a mix, and the more you have of the former, that is, the one that precedes interest in the subject, the harder it will be to decide what to do. And he explains this a little further. What should you do if you're young and ambitious, but don't know what to work on? That is probably the first form of ambition, the one that precedes interest in the subject. What you should not do is drift along passively, assuming the problem will solve itself. You need to take action, but there is no systematic procedure you can follow. When you read biographies of people who've done great work, it's remarkable how much luck is involved. They discover what to work on as a result of a chance meeting or by reading a book they happen to pick up. So you need to make yourself a big target for luck. And the way to do that is to be curious. Try lots of things, meet lots of people, read lots of books, ask lots of questions. David Senra often emphasizes this in the Founders Podcast, and it's worth repeating. So you need to make yourself a big target for luck. And the way to do that is to be curious. Try lots of things, meet lots of people, read lots of books, ask lots of questions. When in doubt, optimize for interestingness. Fields change as you learn more about them. What mathematicians do, for example, is very different from what you do in high school math classes. So you need to give different types of work a chance to show you what they are like. But a field should become increasingly interesting as you learn more about it. If it doesn't, it's probably not for you. Don't worry if you find you're interested in different things than other people. The stranger your tastes in interestingness, the better. One sign that you're suited for some kind of work is when you like even the parts that other people find tedious or frightening. But fields aren't people. You don't owe them any loyalty. If in the course of working on one thing you discover another that's more exciting, don't be afraid to switch. If you're making something for people, make sure it's something they actually want. The best way to do this is to make something you yourself want. Write the story you want to read. Build the tools you want to use. Since your friends probably have similar interests, this will also get you your initial audience. I know I haven't added much commentary here, but it's because every line is gold, right? I wouldn't be able to improve it if I tried, so let's keep going. There are a lot of forces that will lead you astray when you're trying to figure out what to work on. Pretentiousness, fashion, fear, money, politics, other people's wishes, eminent pros. But if you stick to what you find genuinely interesting, you'll be proof against all of them. If you're interested, you're not astray. This is so beautifully said. It's just, I just realized something. Maybe it won't matter where I'll be, in which country I'll live or work. The most important thing is to find something I'm truly curious about, work in that, really put my all into it, and maybe that will open invisible doors for me, right? Wow. I wasn't planning for this. This was not in the script, but it really is something. Anyways, let's go back to the essay. Following your interest may sound like a rather passive strategy, but in practice, it usually means following them past all sorts of obstacles. You usually have to risk rejection and failure, so it does take a good deal of boldness. But while you need boldness, you don't usually need much planning. In most cases, the recipe for doing great work is simply work hard on excitingly ambitious projects, and something good will come of it. Instead of making a plan and then executing it, you just try to preserve certain invariants. I think for most people who want to do great work, the right strategy is not to plan too much. At each stage, do whatever seems most interesting and gives you the best options for the future. I call this approach staying upwind. This is how most people who've done great work seem to have done it. I think that's a perfect note to end this episode, and stay tuned because we'll explore more in upcoming episodes. And it's going to be incredible. So that is where I'll leave it. If you haven't yet subscribed to the podcast or YouTube channel, I'd really appreciate it if you did. Your support goes a long way in motivating me to keep chasing my hero and sharing this journey with you. Thank you so much for tuning in. Until next time, take care and keep chasing your hero.